Hello, and welcome to the last in the current series of the Life Sciences Podcast. I'm Greg Counsell. This week, we speak to Dr. Simone Toschetti from the Centre for the History of Science, Technology and Medicine here at Manchester about his recent book, The Pontecorvo Affair. And we talk about the recent passing of the world's rarest animal. But first up this week, I spoke to Professor Bambos Kiriakou about his unusual approach to studying biorhythms. Earlier this year, Professor Bambos Kiriakou from Leicester University published the results of a very unusual experiment. After years of studying biorhythms in fruit flies in a lab, Professor Kiriakou took the unprecedented step of repeating his experiment in his own garden. He ditched the control environment of the lab in favour of his children's playhouse, and he got some pretty interesting results. Now, I must apologise for the sound quality in this interview, but it was carried out on Skype, and there's quite a bit of background noise, including a few appearances from his young son. Professor Kiriakou, welcome to the Life Sciences Podcast. Could you firstly tell us a little bit about your research area and how this experiment came about?
I've been working in this field since about 1978, and one of the things that's come out in the last few years is a model of how the clock works in the fly. And it's turned out that the way the clock works in the fly are conserved. So mammals and flies have exactly the same, more or less exactly the same molecules. So we've got this model in the fly. And people like to work on the fly because, you know, the work is fast, it's cheap, and we have a very sophisticated model of how it works in the fly. Trouble is that it's all done in the lab, and we tend to make statements about behaviour in the lab and whether the behaviour is adaptive or not. So under the lab, basically, you put flies in 12 hours of light, 12 hours of dark, yeah. Lights coming on suddenly, going off suddenly, a constant temperature. In the wild, it's not like that at all. So we wondered, what would it look like if we took our flies and put them in the wild? Would we see exactly the same things as we saw in the lab? Would the mutants that don't have a clock in the lab appear not to have a clock in my garden? And we also did the experiments in my collaborator's garden in Italy. So we had a whole season's worth of data, and we could compare our results between Italy and England, and between what we saw in the field and what we saw in the lab. And what we found was quite interesting in that a lot of the things that we take for granted from the lab experiments didn't seem to be true at all in the wild, which means that maybe some of our ideas need to be revised about how the clock works, and particularly what we think is adaptive.
So what kind of differences did you actually observe between the garden and the lab?
In the lab, lights come on, lights go off. What flies do is they start to be active just before the lights come on and just before the lights go off. And so people have thought that this was the fly's clock allowing them to anticipate lights on and anticipate lights off. Because if you anticipate lights on and lights off, you can get ready, you know, for the challenges of the day. And that's adaptive. But it turns out that flies don't anticipate anything. They just react to things. What happens in the wild is during the morning, as lights come on very, very gently, all flies become active at the same time, whether you're a mutant or not. In the lab, you raise the temperature, flies have a siesta in the middle of the day, and everybody calls it the siesta. It's like, you know, Spaniards and Greeks and Italians that have a siesta because it's hot. That's adaptive. Well, actually, in the wild, the opposite happens. The flies don't have a siesta in the afternoon. They get very, very active when it gets warm.
It seems like you've come across some pretty fundamental differences here. So why do you think it's taken so long for somebody to carry out an experiment like this?
Well, I think, you know, with biology, you tend to like to do things in the lab because it's easier. Interestingly, two studies, one in hamsters and one in mice. Mice are nocturnal, yeah, in the lab. Mice nocturnal. Hamsters are nocturnal in the lab. Well, two studies very recently did the same as we did in the flies. In fact, they did it before us. They mice and hamsters out in the wild, and they looked at their behaviour, and it turns out they're not nocturnal at all in the wild. They're diurnal. They're active during the day in the lab. So in the comfortable environment of the lab, the animals take a certain kind of behaviour, and we build all our models based on that. Rodents, of course, are nocturnal. Turns out you put mice in the wild, as one of my colleagues did in a Russian forest, and he monitored their behaviour. they're not nocturnal, they're diurnal. So again, that's a big surprise. So we have to be a little bit careful when we extrapolate data from the lab with these complex phenotypes, and we don't overinterpret the data. It's just a warning shot across the bows.
Bruno Pontecorvo was an Italian nuclear physicist. He was also a British citizen whose work contributed to our understanding of neutron decay and ultimately led the way for nuclear fission. He disappeared in 1950 whilst on holiday in Italy, and it later turned out that he had defected to the USSR, where he continued to work for the rest of his life. Earlier this year, Dr. Simone Tachetti from the Centre for the History of Science, Technology and Medicine here in the faculty released his fascinating new book, The Pontecorvo Affair. I met with him to find out more about his book and the enduring power of Bruno Pontecorvo's story.
This is a book really about a very important period in the history of the science that we know. It's the 1950s, there's the beginning of the confrontation between superpowers, there's a lot of political tensions. There's obviously the scientists being worried and campaigning for a different use of the knowledge that they have contributed to develop. So there's all these issues brought together in one interesting case, the case of a scientist that basically at some point leaves everything behind in the West and clandestinely disappears, is basically missing for the following 5 years, and then he reappears during a press conference in Moscow saying, "All right, guys, I'm sorry, but I've moved on the other side of the Iron Curtain." But this is really a unique case for one important reason. This was a scientist with hands-on experience on what it meant to do research on a number of issues, such as the prospecting of uranium. We're talking about a scientist who had contributed to the design of the first heavy water nuclear reactor that was built in Canada. So why in the last 60 years we've known so little about him, given that his contribution to wartime atomic energy projects made it so important? There's definitely a sense that Pontecorvo has never had any duty in relation to weapons design or anything like that. But obviously these are the final steps of, you know, longer processes that entail other important aspects, such as, for instance, the production of fissile materials, on again how to prospect uranium. I mean, we're talking about a confrontation between superpowers, a confrontation on basically finding the raw materials. You need skills, you need experience, you need instruments to do that. Pontecorvo had it. We know that immediately after the defection, basically the strategy put in place by government officers in this country, well, not just in this country, in the United States as well, was basically to downplay, to minimize the implication of the Pontecorvo affair. Public figures such as the Minister of Supply could come out and say, "Oh no, 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 he's just interested in nuclear physics, he's just interested in pure science, it would be of no use to the Soviet Union." Exactly because in the meantime, all the details of his previous work during the wartime had been hidden. The reason why we know so little is exactly because of the ways in which information was manipulated in the aftermath of the defection. One can think of this just as a, you know, an exercise in the historical reconstruction of what happened, say, 50, 60 years ago, something that can, you know, be read as a spy story about that actually really happened. But it has obviously actually important implications also for the way in which we understand science, the making of science, even in the present. And obviously we know that some of these issues are so much discussed these days, where obviously there's fears about rogue states producing nuclear weapons, where, you know, that's considered as something that is extremely controversial. I mean, and obviously when you map this present reality in the historical dimension, you start to see actually something even more problematic, which is, okay, if this is what happened in the case of Bruno Pontecorvo, you know, how does it map in the present? And you start thinking, in that case, the manipulation of restricted information was so important. What does it tell us about, you know, what we know now, or what we assume we know now about, I don't know, Iran, you know, producing centrifuges, or, you know, I mean, it's really pointing the finger towards what is that is being revealed and what is that is not, and whether, you know, there's a sufficient balance of evidence for what we know about all these cases.
Last week, the world woke to the sad news that the rarest animal on Earth had died. Lonesome George was a Pinta Island tortoise, a subspecies of the giant Galapagos tortoise, and for the last 40 years, he was the only remaining member of his race. The Galapagos Islands were once home to 15 subspecies of giant tortoise, only 10 now remain, with the total numbers dropping from around 250,000 in the 16th century to only around 20,000 today. When George was discovered living on Pinta Island in 1972, it was thought that his subspecies had been extinct for over half a century, and there was understandable excitement at its reintroduction to the world. He was uprooted and moved to a new home at the Charles Darwin Research Centre on the island of Santa Cruz, where he remained for the rest of his solitary life. Being the most famous tortoise on Earth should have had its perks for George, but he showed after numerous failed mating programmes and apparent aversion to human contact that he was much happier just being on his own. The latter point is hardly surprising, really, when you consider how it is he came to be the last of his kind. For 500 years, the Galapagos Islands were seen as a living larder for whalers and seal hunters, who would arrive with their food stocks depleted and fill the holds of their ships with hundreds of tortoises. They could remain alive for many months on board the ship, and so were an ideal source of fresh meat. But as people settled the islands, their livestock also became a problem. On Pinta Island specifically, a population of goats introduced by farmers munched their way across the landscape and destroyed the food source upon which the giant tortoise relied. It seems sadly ironic that it was the arrival of ships like the HMS Beagle carrying naturalist Charles Darwin which led to the decimation of the giant tortoise population, as it was the slight differences between the subspecies on the various islands which contributed to the formation of his theory of evolution. Lonesome George was adopted by many conservationists as a symbol of our need to end the rapid loss of biodiversity and mass extinction which human activity is causing around the world. But findings from researchers at the University of Chicago have given a glimmer of hope for the Pinta Island tortoise. Genome sequencing has shown that there are a number of hybrid tortoises living on the island of Isabella. They contain genes from several subspecies, including the Pinta Island tortoise. It's thought that this crossing occurred when the whalers and seal hunters travelled between the islands, taking the tortoise with them. But to get back to an animal which even remotely resembles a Pinta Island tortoise from these hybrids would take many generations of selective breeding. That would take time, effort, and a lot of money. And it begs the question, is it worth it? As wonderful as these creatures were, would the world be a significantly better place with a few Pinta Island tortoises back in it? Or are we simply trying to alleviate our collective feelings of guilt by bringing the animals back? I'll leave that one for you to decide. Well, that's it for this week, and for this series of the Life Sciences podcast. So thanks for tuning in, and we hope you've enjoyed our first foray into podcasting. And if you have a few minutes spare, please fill in the short questionnaire linked from the podcast page. It'll be a big help for us to get some of your feedback and hopefully help us to continue to improve the podcast for all of you listening. So join us again in September when there'll be a new voice on the team, and we will continue to bring you all the interesting bits from the world of life sciences. This podcast was written, produced, and presented by Greg Council and edited by Matthew Cobb.